WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Well, let's go!
Not so fast, Brock. We're the heroes, remember?
So
the heroes always arrive in the today nick of time.
During the Cold War era, Rocky and Bullwinkle repeatedly managed to foil the plans of the two evil spies, Boris Badenov and Natasha Fatale. The cartoon series premiered in 1959. Now Rocky, his friends, and enemies are back in the new movie, The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle. The voice of Rocky is done by June Foray, who originated the voice. My guest, Keith Scott, does the voices for Bullwinkle and the narrator in the new film. Scott is also the historian for J. Ward Productions, the animation studio that created Rocky and Bullwinkle. His new book about the studio is called The Moose That Roared. Let's hear a scene from the new film. Boris and Natasha have crossed over from their cartoon lives into the real world. Rocky and Bullwinkle manage to follow, but the talking squirrel and dim-witted moose have trouble fitting into the real world.
So on they walked, two lone figures making their way through a foreign and hostile live-action landscape.
Ah! Thought you said we were in Oklahoma.
Would you like to narrate this movie?
No.
And so on they walked.
Keith Scott, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Who was the originator of Bullwinkle's voice?
The originator was Bill Scott. And, you know, it's kind of funny because there's this movie database.com that keeps insisting I'm his son. And we're not related. And yet I knew him very well. And, you know, because I was always the world's biggest fan of this this property. And he could tell that. He could tell I wasn't just an autograph seeker. So he began a correspondence with me, and he always used to kind of jokingly sign, you know, perhaps I'm your long-lost uncle, Bill Scott.
Did he talk with you about creating the voice?
Yes, he did. He said that originally Bullwinkle was always conceived as kind of, you know, I guess a generic dumb cartoon voice where in old cartoons you always heard the, which way did he go, George? Gee, Rocky. You know, so it was always these dumb sort of characters, as they used to call them. And so he made him what he described as a smart goof. In other words, there was a lot more going on in Bullwinkle's head, even though he had this kind of dumb voice.
Right. Now, what do you do to get that voice? Where do you place your voice in your head?
Well, it's kind of hard for me to physically describe where my throat is doing that, but I think it's because for, I guess, 40 years of my 46 years, I've been the world's biggest fan of this, so it's just osmosis. Listening, and also Bill Scott gave me all the original recording session tapes. So you kind of became like a fly on the wall. You could hear the actors developing these voices or get inside the actors' heads rather than just the character.
So really, I can't describe how I do this. There's a lot of air there and a lot of diaphragm and also a lot of charisma, I think.
You've also done the voice of the announcer, and you do the announcer's voice for the new Rocky and Bullwinkle movie. Who was the original announcer?
Well, that was William Conrad, who was, some of your listeners may remember the TV series Cannon, and he was kind of a fairly rotund guy, but of course, you know, all of these great voice actors that they used were originally in the days of network radio, drama, and comedy. So William Conrad was really well known as the voice of Matt Dillon in the original Gunsmoke.
And he had this very deep, rolling sort of voice. And I'm that man, Matt Dillon, United States Marshal.
But of course, when he did the show, the Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons, he was a lot more cartoony, so it was...
In our last episode, those intrepid heroes, Rocky and Bullwinkle, were being followed by that vicious villain, Boris Badenoff.
That's great. I think it's really funny that you should be both doing the voice of the goofy Bullwinkle and the authoritative announcer.
It's so weird because in this new movie, there's even a line where Bullwinkle's walking through this angry crowd at the university, Wasamariu, which they recreated from the old cartoons. And the narrator says...
and our insipid hero made it through the crowd.
And then Bullwinkle says, "Don't you mean intrepid hero?" And there's a little pause, and he goes, "No."
And did you do those voices back to back, having a conversation with yourself, or did you record them separately?
Pretty much back to back on the read throughs and the pre-record, but as you know, on a big budget picture like this, eventually everything gets replaced. And I think for consistency of character, it's better if you read just one character's lines. In fact, even in the old Warner Brothers cartoons, Mel Blanc always used to admit that he'd do all of Bugs Bunny's lines first and then come back and do Yosemite Sam, or he wouldn't have a voice box left.
Right. Now, you don't do the voice of the Russian spy, Boris Badenov, in the movie, but you have done Boris Badenov for other versions of Rocky and Bullwinkle.
I do Boris's voice in the movie. There's a short section where you see the characters in normal cell animation, and I'd forgotten that because I hadn't seen the whole picture until the premiere last Saturday on the 24th of June. And it was amazing because there's a little tiny section where Boris and Fearless Leader and Natasha enter the real world, and June and I did those voices. I did Fearless Leader and Boris. And then, of course, they become Jason Alexander and Robert De Niro.
Mm-hmm. You want to give us a little taste of Boris?
"With Boris Badenov, incompetent little Botsylvanian spy." Oh, boy, Natasha.
What a great laugh. Now, who is that voice based on?
Well, Paul Frees, the originator of the voice of Boris Badenov and many, many other voices on the old cartoons, actually admitted that he took Boris's voice from a veteran character actor named Akim Tamarov, who, you know, I guess you could see him in Orson Welles' Touch of Evil and a lot of old films from the 40s, like For Whom the Bell Tolls. And he was always these little, very charismatic villains, often with that Balkan dialect. So he took a bit of that and then a little bit of this character that a Jewish comic called Bert Gordon did on the Eddie Cantor show. It was one of those weekly characters that used to appear on old-time radio. The audience would look forward to it. It was called the Mad Russian. And it was always, "How do you do?" So I think he just kind of combined those two voices, and we had this crazy villain.
My guest is voice artist Keith Scott, author of the new book, The Moose That Roared.
Boris, why you're coughing?
I'm used to breathing good old city smog, Natasha. This fresh air is killing me.
More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Keith Scott. He does the voices for Bullwinkle and the announcer in the new movie, The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle. One more voice I want you to do, which is also a voice from J. Ward cartoons, and that's Dudley Do-Right.
Right. Yes, Dudley Do-Right of the Mounties.
The only Mountie ever to arrest a redwood tree for loitering.
Now, is Dudley Do-Right based on the singer and actor Nelson Eddy in his voice?
Yeah, I think originally Bill Scott did a kind of... in one of the old Dudley Do-Right cartoons, they had him deliberately doing that tribute to Nelson Eddy from Rosemarie, where he played the red-coated Mountie.
The singing Mountie?
Well, yeah, it was operatic. That was a Victor Herbert opera, Rosemarie. But when Nelson Eddy had a radio show in Hollywood in the 40s, for some peculiar reason, his theme song was
"A Mama's Little Baby Loves Shortening, Shortening."
And in one of the Dudley Do-Rights, Nell falls over in a fainting spell. So Dudley says,
"I'll revive her with my glorious voice. A Mama's Little Baby Loves Shortening, Shortening. Mama's Little Baby Loves Shortening Bread."
And then she comes to life again, so...
Now let's get back to Rocky and Bullwinkle. What do you love about the Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons?
I've loved them and been a booster of them for so many years. I still think it boils down to the writing. They really were so like light years ahead of their time. I mean, I think the younger audiences coming up today who've been weaned on, you know, all the channels from the days in the crib are far more media literate than audiences 35, 40 years ago. But I think if Rocky and Bullwinkle began today, with those that same sort of very hip and self-reflexive writing style, it would be as big as The Simpsons, I'm sure. As you know, Matt Groening, who created The Simpsons, always used to say that he was influenced by Bullwinkle.
For anyone who's never seen Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons, what's the basic premise?
Well, the premise is that these two zany-looking heroes, you know, the design is just so cheap and funny. This very tall moose and this very short squirrel are best buddies. They live in Frostbite Falls, Minnesota. And in every adventure, they travel the world and foil the plans of this Cold War villain couple, Boris Badenoff and Natasha Fatale. And they do it just by lucking out, mainly. So the whole thing is a takeoff on melodrama and, you know, white-hatted heroes. But it's just done in a very light-hearted, charming, satirical style. But the main thing to say about these cartoons is that they all eventuated when there was so much competition of bland cartoons, you know, cats chasing mice and that sort of thing, so that these stood out for anyone who Bill Scott used to call the smart kids, suddenly picked these out as something special, because at the same time that, you know, Yogi Bear was stealing a pie off the windowsill, Rocky and Bullwinkle were satirizing politics and TV executives and things that really were way over the kids' heads, so that Bill Scott and Jay Ward used to say, you could keep coming back to these cartoons from young childhood through early high school and then into adulthood on three different levels. Then you'd keep getting things that you didn't get the previous time.
Why don't we hear an excerpt of one of the early Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons? And in this one, the spies Boris and Natasha have drained Lake Salle de Bain, which, of course, in French means bathroom.
and
they've drained the lake. They've basically pulled a plug to drain the lake in order to get at a trunk of treasure buried at the bottom. And after they get
the treasure chest of Montezum.
Yes, I kept expecting Montezuma's revenge to be the end of this. But after they get the chest with the treasure in it, they can't open the chest. So they throw it off a little mountain, hoping that when it hits the ground, it will open. But what happens is Boris Badenov ends up falling off the little mountain with the chest, and the chest lands on top of him. As he's falling, Natasha yells some advice to him.
Don't worry, darling. Remember, this is just cartoon. Boris, are you all right?
Natasha, I just found out what happens when a cartoon chest falls on a cartoon character.
What?
It hurts!
And what's more, darling?
What could be what's more?
The chest still isn't open.
Fui and double fui.
That voice, Bullwinkle. Where have I heard that voice?
I heard something like it once when I dropped the chicken bone in the garbage disposal.
That does it, Natasha. Come on. We're going to get an A-bomb.
A-bomb?
A-bomb, come on.
Did you hear that, Bullwinkle?
Sure, they repeated it twice.
You know what A-bomb means?
Certainly. A-bomb is what some people call our program.
I don't think that's so funny.
Neither do they, apparently.
Do you know why Jay Ward decided to have these two Russian spies and make it a Cold War comedy?
I believe that was Bill Scott's decision. He wrote the script for the pilot film, and I think he wrote it in around about Christmas of 1957, and that, of course, was Sputnik era, and it was when the tensions of the Cold War were, you know, at their height. So it was, I think it was just topical, and he was a very topical person. He was, if he hadn't been in animation, I'm sure he would have been one of these comedians like Stan Freberg, you know, who was doing whatever was in the news at the time. Not mother-in-law jokes, but I'm talking like political jokes, you know. So I think then when they created the characters, they based the look of it kind of as a tribute to Charles Adams, the cartoonist, you know, with the Adams family. Gomez and Morticia, as they were named in the TV show, they never had a name in the old panel cartoons, looked very much like Boris and Natasha. And I think once that story developed and then the show was picked up and renewed, they decided to keep those villains because the Cold War had continued and they had ended up in the first 40 episodes as very funny, bumbling characters that looked viable for a long life.
Do you know anything about Jay Ward's and Bill Scott's politics?
The only thing I knew is that, as you know, as I mentioned, Bill Scott's son said that my dad was a screaming lefty, and he was. I mean, he was involved in many causes. He did commercials for Mental Health Foundation. He was a member of the Civil Liberties Union, and Jay Ward, strangely enough, was a staunch Republican. And yet these two got on and giggled all day long, and they were totally politically opposed.
Many of the jokes in Rocky and Bullwinkle had to go over the heads of kids who were watching. Did Jay Ward care whether kids got the jokes or not?
I don't think he really cared, because he was clever enough to realize that they could see it, especially very small kids could watch the cartoons and be enchanted by the odd-looking design. And just the storyline itself, there was a sense of adventure that even the youngest audiences got. But he always spoke very intelligently about his audiences. Whenever he got dictation from the networks or the sponsor saying, you know, too many adult references, too much showbiz material, you know, you're going to offend some Greek national if you do that dialect, you know, or complaint after complaint. And he would always say, you know, the kids are going to get this. You know, audiences have brains. So both of them presumed a degree of intelligence in the viewers, which network people were renowned for doing the complete opposite, you know.
Who were the sponsors of Rocky and Bullwinkle on TV?
General Mills, the big breakfast cereal concern and flour mill. They were the sponsors, and they still, because of a kind of a deal that had to be made when Jay Ward was very ill to get the show sold. One of the unfortunate things for Ward Productions is that there's one clause in there which says that for the continental United States, all the TV rights remain with General Mills into perpetuity.
How did the sponsor have so much control that the sponsors were able to complain about the content of the program?
Because I think in those days, which was only, television had only been a reality for a decade. So there was a lot of practices that had come from, you know, 4 decades of network radio. And in those days, the sponsor, this kind of died out in the late 60s, early 70s, but the sponsors used to own the shows. In fact, General Mills also owned the Lone Ranger. And so, really, if you had a TV show, the sponsor kind of controlled it through their advertising agency.
Well, you say that since the sponsor for Rocky and Bullwinkle had also sponsored the Lone Ranger, Rocky and Bullwinkle weren't allowed to make fun of the Lone Ranger or even his horse, Silver.
Yes, yes. Well, that's what they were told. I think they went ahead and did. I know that there was, there were references to who was that masked man, that famous line from The Lone Ranger.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like they were taunting the sponsor. And to be honest, the sponsors weren't the villains of the story. I think the ones who were really a lot more finicky were the advertising agency, because they lived in fear of the sponsor dropping their account, or the ABC TV network, as I point out, you know, in the book, especially NBC in those days. The three networks were far more conservative than they are these days.
Can you remember something that the network objected to?
They definitely objected to some of the voices in the early days, especially if there was, I think in one of the Hoppity Hooper cartoons, that was a lesser series that he did after Bullwinkle, Paul Frees imitated Senator Everett Dirksen,
who had that kind of a voice.
And they got these fear-filled letters saying, oh, we can't do that voice. And of course, Jay Ward would always play dumb. He said, well, you just made that funny voice up on the spot. And of course, it was a politician.
Well, you quote Jay Ward as having once said, if we paid attention to the list of do's and don'ts supplied by the network, the sponsor, and the agency, all we could say would be hello and goodbye, and we'd even have to shorten that a little.
That was his colorful publicity, but I guess that was in a kind of a way it was truthful, because they would get memo after memo. I mean, Bill Scott gave me a lot of the correspondences for my research in this book before he passed away, and There was daily complaints, but I think a lot of that was in the first season. Then, of course, Rocky and His Friends, which was the original title, went on to surprisingly become the highest-rated daytime show, and these directives got less and less.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of formed that sort of relationship that a lot of creative versus suit things form. You know, finally they learn to live with each other's eccentricities.
Keith Scott does the voices of Bullwinkle and the narrator in the new film The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle. And he's the author of the new book, The Moose That Roared. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Now, it's time to get back to our story.
My guest, Keith Scott, does the voices of Bullwinkle and the narrator in the new film, The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle. He's also the official historian of J. Ward Productions, the animation studio that created Rocky and Bullwinkle, Crusader Rabbit, and George of the Jungle. Scott has written a new book about the studio called The Moose That Roared. Now, Keith Scott, you grew up in Australia, and our listeners could probably hear the remains of your Australian accent. You grew up in Sydney. When did Rocky and Bullwinkle come to Sydney television?
It was in 1960. Australia was the first foreign sale that they had. I don't know if it ever really went to England in a big way. I don't think it did. It was certainly very big in Australia and New Zealand. But, 1960, when I was 7 years of age.
So TV was very new in your house when you started watching Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Yeah, I think we'd only had a set for like a year. Of course, I'd already seen Crusader Rabbit and Huckleberry Hound and Tom Terrific and all of the competition. And again, you know, realized from a very early age that I was one of these, people who loved comic books and cartoon art, Disney caricatures, Mad Magazine, that type of pop culture.
Go ahead.
Kind of embarrassing to say, I still haven't grown up 40 years later.
How did you, as a kid growing up in Sydney, get to meet the people behind Rocky and Bullwinkle?
I think it was just that my interest in the humor and the voices in the show had gone on. And, of course, once that interest remains, you start asking more and more questions that roll around in your head, like, what do these people look like, or who are they, or what are their backgrounds, or how did they come up with these voices, or who wrote the scripts? And it just kept building and building in me until finally I, on a whim, I wrote to a local TV station, and they gave me an address where they thought maybe my correspondence would get to. Well, the first one I wrote to was Doris Butler, who was probably more famous for his Hanna-Barbera characters like Huckleberry Hound and, you know, Mr. Jinx from Pixie and Dixie.
Mr. Jinx, who clobbered the miserable nieces to pieces like.
And those characters. But he was at like 5 feet 2 inches tall, and he was like a little Irish pixie and known for being one of the warmest people in Hollywood. Well, you know, I never expected to get an answer from these people because they seemed so daunting to someone so young. But he couldn't have been nicer. He sent a very detailed letter. He gave me Bill Scott's address to write to, his home address, June Foray's address. So it really started as a kind of super fan meets his idols and eventually got into the same line of work as them while they were still alive to see that happen. So it really, you know, it's very strange the way fate takes you sometimes.
You started off doing voices for cartoons and commercials in Australia. Mm-hmm. What kinds of characters on the cartoons and commercials?
Very similar to what the J. Ward actors did, because when you're doing cartoons, sometimes they'll show you a model sheet of a character, and they say, well, it's kind of like, you know, and then generally when they say that, it means it's either an impersonation of a famous, you know, actor, or an exaggeration of that person. So there's a local cartoon series that we make in Sydney for based on a German property. Of course, it's redubbed when it goes back to Europe. But I do the two villainous characters in that, and I based one of them on this very sort of
temperamental character that this radio actor here in Hollywood called Joseph Kearns used to play Mr. Wilson on Dennis the Menace, you see.
And then his offsider was called James. And they were just kidding around when we saw this little penguin, this very obsequious little penguin. And for some reason they called him James. So everyone just looked at each other and said, James Mason.
So I've got this little penguin who talks like James Mason. Yes, master, whatever you say.
Do you have to do anything to protect your voice and to protect your throat?
Not really. No, I never have. I've got, I guess I'm blessed with a strong constitution because I do all the things I shouldn't. I drink too much coffee. I still smoke an occasional cigarette. So I really think a lot of these people who use their voice a lot, your voice just gets much stronger with use, you know, and probably abuse. I've never had a sore throat in 40 years of doing this.
Wow.
And yet the strange thing is, I've never had nodules or anything like that, but I'm sure if a voice teacher heard me doing, you know, like Yosemite Sam, or anything like that, they'd be quaking, saying, don't do that to your throat.
It's funny because one of the things you have to do while you're doing all these voices is drop your Australian accent. Like, you can't do Bullwinkle with an Australian accent. Or maybe you could. That would be interesting.
Well, I don't know about that, mate.
Right. So you had to learn to speak American, among other things.
Yes, I think it's because of my interest in animation history and so on, I've kind of had the American dialects in my head for so many decades that it's very easy for me to hear with a pair of headphones on if I'm doing the accent correctly, you know. And also with British voices, I mean, I can put on a very broad Australian, you know, like Paul Hogan, you know, one of those Australians.
Right.
And then I think it's just through constant listening to tapes of famous people that I could go from, you know, doing Paul Hogan to a very well-known English voice like Alec Guinness. I want you to build that bridge and officers will do the work of enlisted men. And then go to some American voice.
Like Bullwinkle Moves.
Or even an amalgam, you know, like an American star, but with one of those odd accents like Schwarzenegger, who's like,
I am a cybernetic organism, living tissue over metallic parts.
or Stallone, which is kind of almost a cartoon voice in himself.
I need no manager, you know.
That's true. It is really almost a cartoon voice in itself.
It is. It's very, you know, because that scene in Rocky with Burgess Meredith where he said, come on, kid, listen, I got pain, I got experience.
Oh, I got pain, I got experience too, you know.
My guest is Keith Scott. He does the voices for Bullwinkle and the announcer in the new movie, The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.